nationally recognized speaker, facilitator, and author Steve Klein sits down with the most fascinating difference makers in Dallas-Fort Worth. Hear from top CEOs, local entrepreneurs, and key playmakers in business right now with your host, Steve Klein.
Tom Landry said, if you play at a high level, the bounces go your way. Hi, I'm Steve Klein, and welcome to Playmakers Talk Show. In the studio today are two guests who play at a high level. Our first playmaker transformed the liquor business in Dallas, while our second playmaker sells sports and entertainment collectibles. With us today is the founder of a company whose name, according to the dictionary, is something attractive, desirable, tasty, and or pleasant, while our second playmaker's company owns 100% of the NBA trading card market. These great playmakers are Joe Jansen. Joe is founder, owner, and president of Goody Goody Liquors, and Mark Warsop, CEO of Panini America. And we're going to begin today's show with Mark. Mark Warsop, CEO of Panini America, is a sports and entertainment collectible company, and he has 22 years collectibles experience, 13 years with the Panini Group, and 9 years with the Topps Company. Working his way through the Topps European office, Mark eventually served the last 5 years of his tenure responsible for all the company's European marketing activity, as well as managing sports collectibles. In 2001, Mark joined the Panini Group as marketing director for Panini UK and ascended to the CEO of Panini America in 2009. As CEO of Panini America, Mark has spearheaded growth of over 400% and elevated Panini America to market leader status in less than 5 years. Mark, welcome to Playmakers Talk Show.
Thank you.
You started out in Europe. You're from the UK. So how did you get started in the trading card business?
Wow. You're testing my memory now. In terms of trading cards, I really got into the trading card business through acquisition. I was working for a publisher in the UK called Merlin, and we were doing collectibles, but more in sticker format for children. And that business had picked up the FA English Premier League rights just after the Premier League was formed. It used to be the First Division, Second Division, and they built this elitist league called it the Premier League. And we picked up those collectible rights. And at the time, the football sticker collections or soccer sticker collections in the UK were selling around 5 to 10 million packets per year. And when we pitched that business, we told the Premier League that we would double that business within 1 year, take it to 20 million packets. In year two, maybe 30 million packets. And then in year three, get to a lofty number of 50 million packets. Well, in year one, we sold over 70 million packets of the very first Premier League collection.
And this was back about how long ago?
This was back in 93, 94, so many years ago. And the success of that company, Merlin Publishing, which was ranked in the UK the fastest growing company over a five-year period, independently owned company, spiked the interest of Topps in America, who were looking to expand their business into Europe, had tried themselves many times and failed. So they wanted to acquire a business that already had some footing in Europe, and they acquired the Merlin Publishing business in 95. So hence I became the marketing manager for a trading card manufacturer, and that's how, you know, my trading card experience began.
Well, I'm going to ask you a little bit about the beginning of Panini America, but you were talking about stickers. Now, are stickers more popular in Europe than they are in the United States, and are they becoming more popular here in the States?
Yeah, absolutely. Stickers, the trading card business in Europe is really very immature. It's not established in the same way that it is here in the U.S. On the flip side, in Europe, everyone collected stickers, and it tended to be a children's activity. You'd get a sticker album. It has spaces for 400 to 500 stickers. You'd open the packets very much like trading cards, except they're stickers, and there's a number on the back of the stick, and you'd place that sticker within the album. And in many senses, it was really the only publication on the market that would give you a full catalogue of every player that's playing in the league, every team in the league, every player in the league. So it was quite a nice keepsake. And, you know, in the past 5 or 6 years, we've been introducing stickers to the U.S. market, and it's been a bit of an education process for the consumer because, you know, they're so used to getting trading cards now and looking for pieces of memorabilia or autographs that it's a new concept. But we mainly target, you know, mums and children. And again, you know, the sticker album, because you place all the stickers in there, it's one of the only places that you're going to be able to flick through and see every player that plays within the league. That's quite difficult to do with trading cards.
Yes, it is. I'm fascinated by the beginning of Panini and soccer, or true football in Europe, was the beginning of that. And tell us a little bit how the two brothers started the business.
Right. So, I mean, soccer's always been the backbone of the Panini business throughout Europe and the world. And the business started, the Panini brothers, Benito and Giuseppe, and there's a third brother actually called Franco, used to own a newspaper distribution business in Italy. And in the mid to late 50s, they introduced some images of Italian soccer players into that newspaper to try and increase the circulation of the newspaper. Well, the images of the soccer players became more popular than the newspaper itself. So in 1961, they released the very first standalone sticker collection in its format that is known today, the album and the sticker packets, Blind. And from that day on, we've manufactured that sticker collection every single year, fully licensed with the Italian Football Federation. And the player itself is actually called Calciatori, which in Italian basically means players.
And that evolved with cards in Europe too. Now, you came to the United States about 5 years ago, and you opened up Panini America in the U.S., but I understand that your wife was actually more keen on coming here than you were initially. Is that how it worked?
Well, yeah, I mean, when it was no surprise when the call came actually from the owner in Italy that you know, he needed to speak to me initially. I'm, you know, curious, you know, why does he need to see me? And I was asking my boss in the UK at the time, the MD, you know, why does Mr. Salustro need to see me? And, you know, he wouldn't tell me. He said, well, you know, he doesn't want me to tell you. He wants to tell you himself, because he was so excited about bringing me the news. But what had happened is we had just started to try and move some business to the U.S. market, and we had already acquired the NBA trading card rights completely exclusively without even having a single member of staff in the U.S. No offices. The NBA gave us that license completely on trust, based on the level of marketing activity and marketing support that we do across the world. You know, they found that model, they were very excited about it. It hadn't been done in the US. You know, manufacturer had released product and put it out into the market and sold it on the merit of the product itself without any marketing support. And we'd promised that we would do a lot of marketing, and we've been true to that word. So we set about originally looking for offices in New York. We interviewed a lot of industry veterans. And then as luck would have it, the Don Russ business became available here in Dallas. And within...
That was about the same time.
It was about the same time, yeah. We managed to get the rights in December, and it was announced, the trade, that we had those exclusive rights in December. And we acquired all the assets of Don Russ in March of the following year. And within about 3 weeks of the phone call, originally from Dallas to Modena, we had acquired that business and all those assets. And to be perfectly honest, it was absolutely the best thing that could have possibly happened, because, you know, the trading card business in the U.S. is extremely complex. And without acquiring the assets and the skill set of the 47 people that we inherited from that business, we wouldn't be where we are today. There's no question about that.
Well, you now have, as I mentioned in the opening, 100% of the NBA trading card market. You have 50% of the NFL and the NHL market. You're looking at revenues more than $100 million. But in doing some research about the cards, I remember as we were talking before the show started, I was a kid and I had the cardboard cards that I collected, and we wrapped them in a rubber band. We didn't take care of them. But it's a little more sophisticated now. It's more than just that card, and it takes a while to develop it. Talk a little bit about the technology of the actual card and how long it takes to actually come to market.
Exactly. For example, every single trading card set that we build, we start on an 8-month cycle. So we'll sit down and we have a brainstorm meeting, look at that particular brand, how it performed last time, what the collectors liked about that particular brand, what didn't work so well, and we start the process of developing and re-engineering that brand. And then we work all the way through. But as far as you know, sometimes trading cards can get pigeonholed into one particular consumer. But in NBA, for example, we release 22 different collections per year.
22 collections times the number of players. That's a tremendous amount of cards.
It's a huge amount of cards. But what we're very specifically trying to do is target a different consumer and have a unique selling point for each individual brand. So, you know, we don't want to be pigeonholed as it being strictly a, you know, very small hobby consumer or an aging hobby consumer. We develop cards that target children using a lot of technology, using QR codes where, you know, you can get the trading card, scan that card on your cell phone, and it will play some video footage of that player playing.
Are the kids using this?
This is on the market and it's currently being used. We do a number of events each year because we have very strong relationships with the players, where we get exclusive footage of the players as rookies are going into the league. We get them to talk about their experiences in college and how excited they are about being drafted in the NFL. And it's unique footage, and the only way you can get it is by scanning the code on the card. So, you know, we do cards that vary from $1 per packet all the way up to as much as $1,250 for a 10-card pack. And those card sets are all targeting varying different types of consumers.
Well, I did some research and saw that some of your cards, some of your single cards, are sold for the $30,000 to $40,000 range per card as a collectible.
Per card, absolutely, yeah. Some of the very higher-end sets that we do, we do some very rare cards, some cards that are even numbered to one of one. We only make one of them, and we insert them into the set, and the collectors are avidly looking for those. And what you tend to see is when you have a rookie or a player that is performing extremely well, the value of that card shoots through the roof on the basis that, you know, in 20 years' time, if that player goes on to win 5, 6, 7 championships, the rookie card is the card that will be the most valuable. So Blake Griffin, as an example, in the year that we released that season's NBA product, the Blake Griffin cards were selling for a very mediocre value on the market. If you remember, Blake was injured for the entire first season. 1 year later, when he starts doing all these incredible dunks, his trading card values of cards that were sold the prior year just went through the roof, with one card selling, as you say, for $38,000 on the secondary market. That's not a bad investment.
Not a bad investment at all. Now, the website is paniniamerica.net, paniniamerica.net. And can the consumers go there and find out where to buy your cards?
Absolutely, yeah. We have a store checklist on the website. We also have an online store, which is icollectpanini.com, and all the products are available on that website. A lot of the mass market trading card sets, which are available for the casual collector, and children are also available in Walmart and Target. And then if you know where your local hobby shop is, you'll find a lot of the more higher-end trading cards. And, you know, if you don't know where your hobby shop is, we have a store list online.
So, again, it's paniniamerica.net, and I guess you have everything plus that the old trading cards have except the bubble gum.
That's right. Well, there's a story behind why the bubble gum had to go. If you remember cards from the 60s and 70s with the bubble gum, the card would have been just that piece of cardboard that you remember. And the UV varnish that we now apply to cars, the gold foil, the special print technology, is not food safe. So the gum had to go. As the consumer demanded a higher quality card, sadly, you know, the gum had to go. But good thing about trading cards is they don't rot your teeth.
That's right. Mark Warsop, he's the CEO of Panini America. Mark, thank you very much for being on Playmakers Talk Show.
You're welcome.
Don't go away. We have more. We have the founder, president, and of Goody Goody Liquors. We're going to talk about the liquor business for the last 50 years. Don't go away. Back right after this.
Operation Kindness is the oldest and largest no-kill animal shelter here in North Texas. Each day, its staff and volunteers care for an average of 300 homeless dogs and cats in its shelter in Carrollton, plus 100 more animals living in foster homes throughout the Metroplex. Learn how you can adopt, donate, or volunteer with this nonprofit group by visiting their website at operationkindness.org or by calling 972-418-7297. operationkindness.org.
Eat a sub at Jersey Mike's in March and help wipe out kids' cancer. All DFW Jersey Mike's locations are donating money to wipe out kids' cancer for every sub sold this month. On Wednesday, March 26, WOKC Day, Jersey Mike's will donate 100% of sales to wipe out kids' cancer. Eat a sub at Jersey Mike's this month and make a difference for kids with cancer. Visit WOKC.org for more information.
And welcome back to Playmakers Talk Show. Our second guest is Joe Jansen. Joe is the founder, owner, and president of Goody Goody Liquor, a pioneer in the Texas wine, beer, and spirits industry. The first location for the local family-owned company was a modest 15-by-50-foot store on Greenville Avenue, which opened 50 years ago in 1964. Goody Goody has 20 stores across Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, Longview, with another opening in the Houston suburb of Copperfield in early April. Joe, welcome to Playmakers Talk Show.
Good to be here.
Glad to have you here. You have an unusual beginning of your business, so rather than my talking about it, tell us the unusual name of your first liquor store and what made you get into it and buy it.
Well, when I was working on my MBA in college, I always wanted to get into business for myself. So I did a small research report on small business and found out that retail liquor had the lowest rate of failure of anything going from start. I don't know if that's true today, but it was then. So I thought, what the heck? I like to drink, like to have a good time. That sounds like a good business. So after getting out of college, borrowed $500 from the Longview National Bank. My mama had to co-sign the note. My wife and I moved to Dallas.
$500 to get started, okay.
That's how we did it. And we moved to Dallas, both got jobs, saved almost every penny we made. And within about 6 months, we bought that little 14-by-15 store. And the name of that store was Goo Goo, G-O-O-G-O-O.
Goo Goo Liquors?
Goo Goo Liquors. Now, the guy that had the store had that stupid name because he did neighborhood delivery. People would call in and get a six-pack of Jack's, half pint of Old Crow, and a pack of Paul Malls, you know, and he'd take it to the house. He had that stupid name, so when they went into the Yellow Pages, didn't have cell phones in, went into the Yellow Pages, they could always remember the name, and no matter what time of night it was, they could remember Goo Goo. So when I bought the store, I added a DY to Goo Goo and made it Goody Goody. I saved $600 on having to buy new sign plates, and $600 was a lot at those days. So that's how we got the name Goody Goody.
And obviously you didn't think Goo Goo was that good a name back then.
Yeah. Anyway, that's how we got to be Goody Goody, and we're still Goody Goody today.
Well, you moved after that store was a little bit too small for you. You just moved next door. Is that correct?
Yeah, there was a convenience store next door, and they never did make a go of it. It went out of business, and I talked to the landlord, and so in 1969, we moved next door.
And you've been growing ever since. You are now located all over North Texas. You're moving into Houston. How many stores do you have right now?
We have 20 stores with six wholesale operations in the our business, we have what they call a Class B wholesale. We sell to bars, restaurants, hotels, clubs. We service over 2,000 hotels and restaurants. And we have to have a separate warehouse in every county because you can't transfer across county lines. So we have six separate warehouses that we do all this out, some in Houston, some in Longview, four here in the Dallas area, Tarrant County, Dallas County, so on, Denton County.
Yeah, we were talking before the show started about the unusual laws in the state of Texas in terms of what you can and can't do, and you have all this tremendous information about the history of liquor since 1964. But you started out that your first inventory was valued about what, $2,400 when you started?
That's a half pint about every 4 feet on the shelf. Yes,
and
sir, that's
that
exactly right.
And your sales were about $48,000 that first year.
The guy I bought it from, his sales were $48,000 that year. My first year, I did $54,000. Huge increase.
Yeah, huge increase. And now your annual revenue is over $100 million, is that
over
correct?
Over $225 million.
Even more than I have written down. Well, let's talk about Goody Good itself. There's a lot of liquor stores out there. And you and I were talking before we started about the changes lately with other liquor stores coming into the Dallas area, cities going wet. Yeah. Some cities, as you were talking about, going damp. You can talk about that in a second. But what's the advantage? What do I receive as a consumer when I walk into a Goody Goody liquor store?
Well, we've always tried to we set a motto years ago and said we make a profit because we serve the public. We don't serve the public to make a profit. And we really have tried to live by that. So when you come into a Goody Goody, we try to take care of you. We try to be extremely fair. We have very good pricing. Our inventory selection and so on and so forth is, we think, second to none. What we know is second to none. So that's some of the things you get when you come into a Goody Goody store.
Well, I mentioned the term damp, which you used a little while ago, because a lot of cities have gone, and you call that, where they're just beer and wine only, damp rather than wet.
Right, right, right. Yeah, well, the markets have changed a lot. When I went in business in 1964, there was only one precinct wet in Dallas. It was Precinct 1. And since then, they've been systematically going wet around. It was dry all the way from here to past Kansas, because Oklahoma was even dry, and it was dry all north and here and so on. On the east side, you had to go to Longview or Shreveport to get liquor, and west you had to go forever. I don't know how far, but they started doing. But anyway, we located all of our stores, and everybody in this industry did, located all of their stores according to these wet-dry lines, and it's like recently Plano went wet. When that happens, well, then that was 28 new stores that took the Plano out of the Dallas market. So that's made a real change and made it we've had to kind of change our business plans because of that to readjust to this change that's going on.
Well, back in 1964, Dallas wasn't anywhere near as large as it is right now. And Dallas going north wasn't much farther north than about Northwest Highway, I'm guessing. But did you have a tremendous amount of customers from Oklahoma, from McKinney? Did they drive south to Goody Goody?
Oh, yeah. We had people would come in from out of town. They'd have they'd come in a van. They'd take up for the whole collection for the whole neighborhood. And the guy'd come in, let's see, Mr. Brown here, he needs this, this, and this. And Miss What's-Her-Name needs this, this, and then so on and so forth. And they'd load the whole van up and haul it off. And they'd take turns coming in. So we had people coming in from all over to this area to trade. And that's changed dramatically, like I said, over the years.
It was more of a social thing back then rather than an individual thing as it is today.
Yeah, well, I guess it was kind of like carpooling.
carpooling for liquor back then.
Yeah, they were carpooling.
Well, you've been in the business for 50 years. Right. We were talking earlier about a lot of the changes, some of the competitors we were talking about. There is no one liquor store company that still has the founder still running the business as you have. What changes you've seen over the year? Have you had any one point in your life or career where everything started changing?
Are you talking more about in the liquor industry?
In the liquor industry, in retail, anything that really changed, or anything even in your life over the last 50 years that changed that had an impact on Goody Goody?
Well, one of the things I guess had an impact on Goody Goody was back in the 80s when they had the savings and loan crisis. We had built a store on Greenville Avenue, and when I talked to the banker, back then you'd get a construction loan, and then you'd get a loan from an insurance company or something for the permanent loan. And the banker came up and said, "Joe, you don't want to waste all that money. I mean, my gosh, you're going to have to pay for all these new fees and everything to change over. Why don't you just take our loan, and in 5 years it's an automatic renewal as long as everything's going okay and you made all your payments." Well, 5 years went by and Goody Goody was doing great, but the damn bank was broke. And so they called the note. So that was, I guess, one of the kind of a game-changing thing. We got that fixed with the bank. Luckily, the banker that had told me that worked for another bank, and so he was willing to testify to that effect. So the bank said in that case they'd go in and renew the note. And I paid it off in 5 years and changed banks. But
that
was kind of a changing experience for me there.
Well, you're talking about your helpful staff earlier, one of the biggest differences in Goody Goody and other companies. But you had something interesting happen back, what was it, around, I'm looking for the date, 1973, June of 1973, where you had a fire as a result of lightning striking your store?
That is true. We had a lightning struck the store. I remember there was a lady lived across the street called me and said, "Joe, your store's on fire." So I got in the car, ran down, and sure enough, the whole dang thing was on my blaze. The roof caved in. It was just about totally destroyed. The inventory was all, burned. So we went to work, and I put all of our people up in a motel, and we worked 24 hours a day. And within a couple of weeks, we got that store back open. I can't remember if it was 2 or 3 weeks, but we worked around the clock. We had we did it in shifts. We'd go sleep 3 or 4 hours at the motel I had, and we took turns in the room.
So there was somebody sleeping in the hotel all the time.
All the time, right. We just kept it going until we got the store back open, and we kind of went from there.
Amazing how that has happened. Were there many other competitors in your area? You were talking about District 1, mm-hmm. but were there many other liquor stores near Goody Goody at the time?
Oh, my goodness. Back in that day, since this was the only wet spot, there was 4 or 5 major chains in Dallas. Dallas had more chains than any place in the United States, just about. You had the A&A Liquor, Siegel's Liquors, Centennial Liquors, Warehouse Liquors. I'm sure I'm missing some.
So it was to your benefit to get that store up and running as quickly as possible.
Yes, it was. I had a lot of competition. But like I say, there was a lot more business in Dallas at that time because it was kind of like an oasis. And systematically, that's changed over the years.
Well, you've been in business now for 50 years. You're celebrating your 50th anniversary this year. We have a lot of people listening in the audience that are entrepreneurs or business owners. Is there any advice you'd give somebody that's in business or going into business as far as what they should do? As far as your background, your expertise over the last 50 years?
Well, find something that you know something about. I think that's the first thing. Find something you know something about and shoot with a rifle, not with a shotgun. Stay with it. When I first went into business, I started out with this one little liquor store, but I was very ambitious. I opened a second liquor store. I had a situation where some people owed me some money. I took over a nightclub. I sold the liquor store. The guy couldn't pay me all the bills, so I ended up with an apartment house. So out of all of that stuff, I had an apartment house, I had a nightclub, I had a liquor store, and I got into some other things. And the defining time of my life was when I finally came back from another venture in New York and decided I was going to sell whiskey for a living. That's all I was going to do. Went to the bank. I was legally bankrupt at that time. They did a survey, and my net worth was minus $12,000. I went to see Grumpy, my banker. I called him Grumpy. His name was George. And I said, "George, I need some help." And he said, "Joe, I tell you what, back then banks were different. The guys could make their own decisions. You have to go to loan committees and all that stuff." He said, "I'll make you a deal." He said, "If you'll write me a letter and sign it, tell me you'll promise me you'll stay in that store and run it yourself, I'll give you the money." And he said, "You're the only guy I've seen that little store that you took over down there go through about 10 different hands, and they all went broke, but you're the first one ever did any business down there. If you'll promise me that, I'll give you the money." He gave me the money. I started drawing it out. I got within $1,000 of running out. We turned it, and I paid George back, and that was kind of the turning point. So my advice to you is to find something, stay with it, shoot with a rifle, not with a shotgun.
And the rest is history. Joe, thank you very much for being on Playmakers Talk Show.
Thank you, sir.
Joe Jansen, founder, owner, and president of Goody Goody Liquors. You can check Goody Goody Liquors out at goodygoody.com. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Steve Klein. This is Playmakers Talk Show. You can check us out at playmakerstalkshow.com for all the past shows you can listen to and upcoming guests. And we'll see you again next week.
Who will Steve be interviewing next? Find out on Playmakers Talk Show with Steve Klein every Friday afternoon at 3 on 770 KAAM. Hear this interview again by going to Steve's website, playmakerstalkshow.com.